Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel feeding in!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Oh, here we go again, everybody. Yes, my favorite time of the week. Another episode of The Suspendables coming at you with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and him, Russ Cortinel, okay, back in L.A., setting records for White Claw and wine consumption. Okay, there it is. Yeah, there's a little White Claw. Okay, just to set things off. Rusty, how are you?
Good, thanks, buddy.
The reason I'm laughing is one of my all-time favorite people in the world. Okay, all-time. I fell in love with this guy back at the fantasy camp in several years ago. And he's just a peach of a guy. I'm going to give you that. We got a guest, okay, Rusty? So let's get right to it. Okay? Let's get to it, baby. I'm going to give you the stats, okay? I'm going to give you this guy's stats. And if you can figure it out, if you're driving in your car right now, listening to the show, or you're at home with your headset, or you're mopping the floor or something, okay? If you can figure out as I go along and you say to yourself, oh, okay, I know who that is. If you get it right,
Jim will send you $1 million.
No. They're going to make more than $1 million. I'll tell you why. They are going to be entitled, Russ, to returning your empties, and it'll be about $1.5 million. Okay? That's,
cheers
okay,
to
here
that.
It is. Okay? Born on June 2nd, 1951. By the way, that's my brother's birthday, June 2nd.
And mine.
You're June 2nd as well?
Yeah.
Come on.
Gemini.
Okay. 2017, he was named one of the top greatest 100 players in the NHL. He played from 1973 to 1992. 17 seasons with the Montreal Canadiens, 3 with LA. Norris Trophy winner twice, 1976-79. Conn Smythe winner. Russ, these are all prizes that you're unfamiliar with.
Fuck off.
A million All-Star appearances. 6 Stanley Cups as a player. 3 as a coach. Team Canada 3 times. And 208 goals, 750 assists, regular season, 144 points, 227 total in the playoffs. Holds a record for plus minus, Russ. Okay. Ready for this?
Plus. Thanks for listening in. The show is over. No,
plus 730, 20 consecutive years making the playoffs. Had his number retired, 19 in Montreal. Of course, I'm talking about the great Dave Lumley. Okay, here's a fantastic Larry Robinson. How are you, Big Bird? What's going on, man?
Great. Just love listening to you guys.
You look
great, Larry, my old teammate, my old coach.
You know, I forgot you were a June 2nd week because we were talking about that and we had the same birthday and I forgot about that, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Can we trade ages?
Well, maybe if you throw in a few of those trophies.
Okay. Which one do you want?
Obviously, when I read these stats, cripes, Rusty, they'll allow anyone into the Hall of Fame. A bunch of shitty stats like that.
Jeez, I mean, Louise.
You got Larry. Hall of Fame was in 1995.
Yeah.
When you hear all these things, Big Bird, I'm going to read a quote because I find it hard to believe from you with all these exceptional things you did as a player. You said a while back, quote, considering how long I played hockey and how many cups I got to win as a defenseman with Montreal, it was my first Stanley Cup win as a head coach. So that's when that was. And that actually is my greatest day in hockey.
Wow.
Is that
one of my greatest? Yeah. And then the reason that I said that is because, you know, as a player, you have one person to worry about, you know, yourself. You got to get yourself ready. But now, you know, as a coach, especially a head coach, you know, you're worrying about the guys getting their sleep. What did they do last night? Where did they go? Did so-and-so have a fight with his wife? And are they going to be ready for the next game? And what's the team? You know, it's just, it's nonstop. So you have 2.5 months of grind, of no sleep, worrying about the next game, worrying about the next day, what you're going to do, the traveling, you know, the guy's getting enough sleep, am I doing the right things? And so when it's all said and done, you were just in charge of, well, at playoff time, there's usually four or five extra guys. So you're basically in charge of 28 people and making sure that those 28 people are playing as one.
Right.
So that's why I said that that was one of my greatest days in hockey, because of that accomplishment. And to make it all even more crazy was that I came in December after Robbie Fatorik got fired. So it wasn't something like, you know, I was expecting. It kind of came on to me all of a sudden, and it was just a great ride.
Yeah, because coaching, you're an assistant with the Devils.
Yeah,
you won a Stanley Cup in 95.
95, and we won in 2003, and we won in 2000.
Yeah. And then you were back and forth there with Jersey.
Yeah.
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 You've had your name on the cup 10 freaking times.
Yeah. That's times. Pretty cool.
And but what people don't know, and they're going to find out right now, is one of the greatest cups you won was the Gretzky Fantasy Camp. You were the head coach. Yes. Okay. We've talked about the Fantasy Camp before, which is a bunch of washed up bantam players with too much cash who want to go play hockey with Wayne. And of course,
yeah.
And you, Larry, but you coached a bunch of, like I say, washed up junior players, and they were drunk or hungover playing these games. And you pulled it
That's
off.
That's the only way you win.
Yeah.
But you want to know something, Jimmy, that, you know, the first few years it was in, Phoenix.
Yep.
And we and everybody stayed at this resort area. I think it was a mountain something resort. It was the best, because when we went to the thing that I found, I have fun anywhere, but the thing about going to Vegas was we lost the intimacy of the pros with the campers. And when we were at that other resort, that was a thing that we did after the games or after everything. Everybody met at the pool. There was beer out, and we sat and told stories.
Right.
And so we kind of lost that a little bit in Vegas, but it was still fun in Vegas. I got to watch Rusty at the tables, and he just about gave me a freaking heart attack.
We did have fun though. And I have to agree with Larry when Wayne first did it in Phoenix, sitting around and I was, you know, obviously one of the retired players that there's two or three on every team. And we got to sit and listen. I got to sit and listen to Larry, and we had Phil Esposito there. Danny Gare was there one year. I'm not sure if Ivan Konway came, but for us, even the pros getting to listen to some of our older players that we followed as kids, it was freaking awesome. And the campers were all just like sitting there. Okay, tell another story. Order these guys more drinks.
Yeah. I made a lot of money at that camp, because I go up to all these guys going, look, you slip me 100. Okay, I'm going to let you sit beside Larry. Okay, if you do that. Yeah. You know what? That was, Rusty, you know what? That was one night too, during that camp, you were there, Larry, in Phoenix, when Eddie Mio got in a fight with Phil Esposito. Do you remember that? He did. Yeah, there was some deal that they got in the restaurant business in New York, and everyone was into their cups a bit. And Eddie gave Phil a little bit of a shot. No. Okay. Now, Phil is as old as you are, Larry, maybe older. Phil Esposito. Oh,
he's probably 5 years older than I am.
He stands up out of his chair and pulls his jacket off and goes, is that right, Eddie? Okay. It was just like, we all went running in there. One of the great stories, Larry, you got so many stories, but I remember asking you, first of all, like, you played hockey 1972, you came into the league, 71, 72?
Yeah, I came in, I was drafted 71, 72, and I spent my first year in Halifax with the Voyageurs. That was the very first year that Montreal had their minor league team in Halifax.
Right.
And we won the Calder Cup that year in Halifax.
I remember you told me, and what did you get paid in 1972 when you signed with the Canadians?
$7,500.
Wow. A week?
No, that was not. You want to know the God's honest truth?
When
We went all, and Rusty knows this, our last paycheck is what, April 7th at the end of the season. And then we have to wait for our playoff bonus. So I had to wait for my playoff bonus to pay my last month's rent. when I was in Halifax.
Wow.
And in fact, I took a job with the Department of Highways for the summer working on the construction on the road that went from Montreal to Ottawa. And my first paycheck went down to Halifax to pay my month's rent.
You had a second job when you played for the Montreal Canadiens?
For the first 2 years, yeah. I made $7,500 my first year and $15,000 my second year.
Larry, when I got to Montreal to play with you back in 88, you know, I came from Toronto and I heard all these stories from the older retired players that would come down to the locker room. And a few of them told me, I think Ivan Cornroy told me, he goes, yeah, we'd win the Stanley Cup. We'd take a week off and then we'd go work for Molson's delivering beer in the summer as a second job.
Oh, you had to.
Yeah. And well, now you've proved it. I mean, you and I were playing. These guys were even much older than you that had to have a second job. So they probably made half of what you made back then.
Yeah, probably. I don't know. All I know is that I found out that John Van Boxmeer, because he was Allan Eagleson's, one of Allan Eagleson's, was his agent. And he came in, I think, 2 or 3 years after me. He made $50,000 his first year.
Yeah.
I was so pissed off. I ran him through training camp.
and Boreas Salming came in and he was one of the first two Swedes to come in. And I think they're paying him like $65,000 or $75,000 to get him over. So 10 times what you're making. Didn't you guys start at the same time? You and Boreas?
Yeah, we came in the same time.
Yeah. Same time, yeah.
That's the way Montreal was back then. Nobody and contracts weren't, you know, made public. And so nobody knew what the next guy was making. So, you know, of course, the GMs never told anybody. And I didn't, at that time, I didn't even have an agent. So, but that was still a lot of money for me.
Yeah.
But that's more money than I had ever seen.
Yeah.
Rusty, that's a weekend for you. $7,500? That's easy. Nothing. That's nothing.
Easy
for
there, Tiger.
of course. So back up a bit, Larry, then you were born in Winchester, lived in Marvelville. So what was hockey like back then in 1928 when you first took up the game?
Well, it was artificial ice. Right.
Jim hasn't changed. He's still an asshole, Larry.
Yeah. Well, you know, even an asshole is good. You need one. Otherwise, there's a lot of backup. Well, I didn't play on artificial ice until I was probably 10 or 11 years old. I only skated on natural ice.
Wow.
We practiced because I lived on a dairy farm. You know, we only played on the weekends, and that was in Russell, Ontario, and it was for the Lions Club. And they sponsored all the house leagues. And so we played in the house league. But then these bunch of little farmers would go around to all the tournaments and all the little cities around there and kick everybody's ass. So we got noticed. So that's how it all happened. I played a junior B when I was 13.
Jesus.
And then I played tier two with the Brockville Braves when I was 16. And as a matter of fact, I went as a centerman. I was a centerman then.
Oh, no.
And so, so I went to training camp and Dan Dexter was there and he said, he looked at me, he goes, "You ever played defense?" And I go, "Why?" He says, "Because we only have two." And math was one of my good subjects in school. So I went, only two. So that means I'm going to play a lot. So I said, yep. And I started playing defense and that's how I became a defenseman.
Was it always going to be hockey for you, Larry, growing up, or was because?
No, I had the opportunity to be drafted with the Ottawa Rough Riders around the same time they drafted Tony Gabriel.
No, come on.
No, yeah, yeah. They didn't really draft me, but they had scouted me as a tight end for CFL football. But I told them I know I was going to play hockey. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
I never knew that about you. The hits just keep on coming, Robinson.
and he hit me behind the net in Montreal when I played for the Leafs.
Right.
He hit me so hard. He gave me the ass first and then the back second and then oh my God, I collapsed like a freaking French crepe. I was going behind Larry. You were just sitting off the back post, and I went around the net, and you just kept coming, boom, ass first, up against the glass, and then you finished me off. And then I was leading the team. I was top 10 in scoring in the league at like 39, 38 games into it. I went on a 17-game scoreless streak after that. And they
after Larry plowed you.
Oh, yeah.
That's okay. I did it on purpose so that you'd come down and play with us.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, exactly. No drinking back in those days. Eh? That stopped immediately, right, in Montreal?
You know what? You know, I never knew that hockey players drank until my first pro game. And Noel Price was my first roommate.
Yeah.
And so we had practice and I come back and Noel's sitting there drinking a beer and he goes, you want a beer? And I went, why do you drink beer? He says, kid, do you drink beer? Well, that's where it started. And I never stopped.
A reminder, the Suspendables are engaged on Facebook. Your comments are welcome always.
So Larry, when you coached, compared to the days when you played, so in the early 70s, Russ has got a million stories and they're hilarious. And then you come on as a coach. Was it difficult for you trying to adjust from when your day as a player, trying to teach guys what you were taught? Or is hockey pretty much the same, Larry, no matter what decade you're playing or coaching in?
No, it's definitely an adjustment because I think I was lucky because I had a really good teacher. Jacques Lemaire was a great coach, a great teacher. I learned a lot just sitting, listening to him and learning from him. So for me, when I became a head coach, I took a lot of the stuff that I learned from him. And of course, I incorporated a lot of my own stuff as well. But I think the biggest adjustment is to make sure when you see a player or you're talking to a player, you go, oh, if you would have done it, this is the way I would have done it. No, you can't do that. Then they all of a sudden then they get on the defensive. It's, you got to kind of look at, okay, what can I do to help him improve to be better at what he does? And that was the big adjustment for me. And then the other thing, of course, is now all of a sudden, you know, you're not just looking at the game. You're going, okay, what adjustments can I make? Who can I put out there against their guy and so on and so forth? So you're constantly making adjustments and readjustments on the bench as well.
Right. Do you like the way the game is now, Larry, compared to when you, I mean, it's so much different, right? Equipment and stuff like that. Do you still like it? I mean, a lot of people
I still love the game, but I, you know, the best thing that they can do right now is to bring the red line back in.
Oh yeah. Because, tell. Yeah.
And the main reason is now the defensemen don't need to have any skill. Just turn around and slap it as hard as you can, pass the defenseman, and then somebody's going and taking off. There's no skill involved. So before you couldn't pass from your zone past the red line. Now you can make a friggin' long pass and it doesn't really matter. So yes, the game is faster, but I think also by being as fast as it is, it's become more and more dangerous for especially defensemen and players. You look at the major injuries that are out there now. I think a lot of it has to do with the speed of the game. And the speed of the game is because the guys are bigger, stronger, faster. So I don't think there's a skill. There's still some great skill players, but the overall skill I think is, passing and receiving passes and everything else isn't as good as it was.
Right. I heard a GM on TV talk about when they changed the rule and took away the blue line or the red line, not one person in that room brought up the speed of the game and how it was going to affect the defenseman being pounded night after night. And so yeah. Larry's correct. Like it's dangerous. And they were trying to make the game, you know, they were trying to take the hooking and holding and all that stuff out of the game. They did, but none of them realized when they did that there was going to be effect that affected the defense like it has.
Yeah. And if you're going to do it, Rusty, then let the goalies play it.
Right. Right.
You know, then you'll take away, then it'll kind of counteract The fact that the D are not going to come back and get pounded.
Before we get out, what do you think of the 3-on-3, Larry?
I think it's fun to watch.
The fans love it, Larry. I've said this many times. You can judge just by the audience. They stay and they stay and watch. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of our games when we played, we had that short overtime. Was it 5 minutes? Frick, the stadium was half empty because we would just play ping pong because we didn't want to lose a point. So there was no offense. It was just protect the point. If they make a mistake, maybe we'll score and get an extra point. But you didn't want to lose that extra point. It was boring as hell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And get rid of the shootout, Larry?
Yeah, it's a waste of time, too.
Yeah,
it's too hard. The onus is on the goaltenders, and that's enough. We have to find a way to keep everybody's attention, but to shorten the game overall. Because comes to the point now where holy mackerel! It's three and a half, 4 hours to do a hockey game. It's just too long.
You're smart because that's what Gretz said a couple weeks ago. I said, why don't you just do the shootout or do the 3-on-3 until someone scores, man? Cause someone's going to, he said, cause the players want the game to end way quicker, man. You know, you got 80,000 games we got to play in. It's too hard on their bodies. You know what
they,
you talked about skilled players, Larry, why don't you name off for any hockey historian? Why don't you name off guys who were on your roster in Montreal? These guys were the best hockey players in the world you played with.
Yeah, I think our 76 team was probably the best team that I ever played on. We had Pete Mahovlich, Van Cornwaye, Jacques Lemaire, Guy Lafleur, Steve Shutt, Bob Gainey, Réjean Houle, Pierre Mondeau, Doug Risebrough, Tremblay, and then on defense he had Pierre Bouchard, Guy Lapointe, Serge Savard, myself, Billy Nyrup, Rod Langway.
Who was the backup Dryden?
Is it LaCroix? For Dryden, it was Bunny LaRocque.
Buddy LaRocque.
Yeah. How about this story? Dryden kind of shit the bed in the first game and we lost against New York. So they're putting Bunny LaRocque in the second game. Dougie Risebrough comes in and warm up, dings one right off Bunny's head. Goes Bunny. Bunny's out, and Ken Dryden went back in, and Bunny never saw the ice again after that.
Oh my God! That
was Dryden kind of stood in his head, but
who? Yeah. So was Scotty your coach the whole time there? No, you must have had.
Oh boy, I had lots of coaches. Scotty was my first coach. Right. Scotty was my first coach, and then. After Scotty was...
Scotty Bowman, of course.
Scotty Bowman. Then I think Claude Ruel coached a little bit. Bob Berry, Jean Perron.
Pat Burns.
Lemaire was there.
Oh, right.
Pat Burns. Yeah.
Wow. What a roster, man. Tell me, and what separates him from other coaches? What was it like playing for Scotty Bowman? I mean, the guys...
Oh, my God. Everybody wanted to kill him because... It's funny, you know, and I understand him more now than I did back then because I've been in the position as a coach, but he did it to keep us off guard. Like we would go, how about this one? My first 3 or 4 years in the league, we never lost a game on the West Coast. Never lost one game on the West Coast.
In 4 years?
In 4 years. And every time we come back from the West Coast, he'd skate the living shit out of us. The next day, just skate the living crap out of us. And then, you're after a road trip and everything else. Then we'd shit the bed the next game because the guys were just dead.
Right.
And then he'd give us a day off. And we're all going, holy geez, we stunk. We're going to get the shit skated out of us. And then nothing. And that's just the way he was. He just kept everybody off balance. But by far, probably the most genius man behind the bench that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
After 4 or 5 shifts, he knew who was going, who he wanted to play against, who he'd shift guy, but he'd always kept two guys together. Lafleur and Shutt always played together. And then he'd throw in either Mihaljevic or Lemaire. Hell, I even played center between them one night in Pittsburgh. Got a goal and two assists.
Like, did you take anything away from Scotty? In terms of what you learned?
Not really, because I never knew what he was thinking.
Right.
You know, to be honest. I mean, he didn't do anything special as far as on ice stuff, because LaPerriere, who was his assistant, or Ruel, they ran most of the practices. It was just his forte, as far as I was concerned, was who he brought into the lineup and how he used his lineup during the game.
Right. I grew up watching you guys play. I'm 10 years younger than you, but I sat on Saturday nights, man, with my dad. My dad was a huge Montreal Canadiens fan. And, you know, Vazigi, you played with him, Larry. Good blessings.
We're still close.
Oh, you are, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We see a lot of each other. Actually, he's going through a real tough time right now. His cancer came back. So
please send my best.
Yeah.
Larry.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. He's, everybody that's listening, send your best, because he's, we don't know how it's going to go, but he's taking chemotherapy right now. And I guess it's through most of his back and in his spine and everywhere. So, but I talked to him and I said, listen, you know, if anybody can fight it, you can. And he's pretty positive, and he says he's going to battle it and whatever. But this guy, you talk about strong. I mean, you look at him and he looks like Popeye, for crying out loud. He's got the biggest forearms that you ever seen. And what was so incredible about him is that if you had a set play, you know, Scotty wanted to run a play or something and show how we were going to break out of the zone, Guy Lafleur was not there, because he basically played the game like off the seat of his pants. He wasn't a structured hockey player, but you could give him a pass. As long as that pass was anywhere between 1 and 2 feet of him, he used to take it off. He's a right-handed shot, and if you pass it up his left side, he'd take his top hand off, grab it with his right hand and bring it across and bring it onto his forehand and not lose a stride. He was unbelievable.
Unteachable, eh? You can't teach that.
Oh, you can't teach that. He had a flair for scoring big goals at big times, and he could put. But he practiced. He would go out. He would be dressed at 4:30 for a 7:30 game.
No kidding.
And probably had about 4 cigarettes by then.
Yeah.
and the thing is that I had practice. He'd do the same thing. He'd get there early. He'd go out and he'd probably shoot between 100 and 200 pucks and just put them boom, 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 boom. Unbelievable. Incredible.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah. Crazy.
And a great guy. Great guy.
Wonderful guy. And he lives up around Ottawa, doesn't he, still?
He actually lives in Montreal. He lives right on the water in Montreal, in Île-Perrot, I think, or whatever. Oh, not too far from Carbo.
Right.
And you know that he's a hell of a pilot.
A helicopter guy, right?
Helicopter pilot. And that's how we found out that he had cancer the first time, is that he went in for a physical. He went in for a physical to get his for his pilot license, because if you're a pilot, you got to have a physical every whatever it is, every 2 years or something like that. And he went in for his physical, and he went right from the physical right to the operating room and had a quadruple bypass. And then while they were doing the quadruple bypass, they found the cancer in his lungs. Awesome. And so he recovered from the quadruple bypass so that they could work on the cancer after that.
Right.
Larry, so, I know he quit drinking years ago, but did he keep smoking, or did he quit smoking too?
He quit smoking for a couple of years and then he started back. And I gave him shit for that. And but he goes, well, what the fuck? What else do you want me to do?
Yeah, right. Right.
You know, so now, but I want to say, I think he's quit smoking now.
Yeah.
Too late, but.
I shy away. I quit all the drugs and booze, Larry, 10 years ago, but that's the cigs I can't give up. I can't give up the cigs. Rusty gives me shit all the
time. It's hard. Oh. It's hard.
we got to talk about because it looks like now the rivalry has gone in hockey like it used to be. You know, I've been out in Edmonton almost my whole adult life, and of course I lived through the great Calgary Edmonton rivalries.
Yeah.
But there's not much of it anymore. You know, it's died out.
Well, there's pockets of it. There's pockets of it. Like the St. Louis, Chicago hate each other.
Oh my God.
I mean, hate each other. That's a big rivalry. I don't know. Well, it's close. It's within driving zone. Right. And something happened, I guess. And then of course you got the, it used to be Detroit, but, and Colorado, but it's not anymore because Detroit are so bad.
Right.
But there's still pockets of rivalries there. I think it's Ottawa and Toronto now, I think. Hey, Rusty?
Yeah.
They don't like each other very much.
The Toronto-Montreal rivalry.
That's why I'm asking.
It'll never go away.
Never go away.
I was in Toronto and Montreal is always, it seems like Montreal always plays the first game of the year in Toronto or vice versa. And so I said to the gang, I'm like, hey, I'll get a table over at the bar there. What's it called in Toronto? The big, the sports bar or something like that.
Yeah. I know where it is. Yeah.
I said, well, I'll get a booth there. We'll go watch the game. And the guy says, Russ, I know you played for the Leafs. I know you played for the Habs. It's $3,000 just for the booth. I'm like, I don't want to go to the game. He goes, it's $3,000 for the booth. And that's before you have one sip of beer. And I said, we'll watch it
in the car.
Another place.
But the reason I bring it up, Larry, because you played in rivalries like nothing. I mean, Montreal, Toronto, Philly was talk about some of those.
The worst
games.
One was Montreal, Quebec. Oh, yeah. That was a war. Oh. That was a war. It wasn't even hockey sometimes. I mean, we had a bench clearing brawl there one night when I think it was Mark Hunter and Peter Stastny or something did something just before the end of the period. And so they kicked everybody off. And I think before they had kicked everybody off, Louis Slager had suckered Jean Hamel in the corner, and Jean Hamel ended up losing his eye over it.
Yikes.
And so anyway, we went off the ice, and then they didn't come in and say, okay, you, or whatever, you're not playing. So everybody comes on for the next period. And Claude Mouton called Mark Hunter over and he goes, Mark, you've been kicked out of the game. So what does Mark do? He goes straight after Peter Stastny and takes Peter Stastny out of the game. And then another brawl broke out. But that's the way it was. I mean, it was amazing. It was amazing. And it was all started because Bergeron,
yeah,
they call him the Tiger or whatever. Yeah. He would stir everything up because he loved the press and he loved to stir all the shit up. And so he would start it all, and then he would go at Chris Nyland or somebody else, and then they banter back and forth. And he wanted to just get, you know, the press going to hype up the games. But
right.
Oh my God,
Larry, I heard a story about you and. I don't know if it's true or not, but you were getting stitched up watching the game from the medical room, and a brawl or something started, and then you went back out and fought somebody.
No way.
That was the Schultz one.
Right.
Kinderchuk hit me with a stick and cut my eyebrow a little bit. So it was right near the end. So I came over and the trainer said, well, why don't you just go in and we'll, you know, get you ready and stitch
one
you
of
up
our drunk, one of our drunk doctors.
Yeah. So anyway, I went in, I loosened my skates and everything else. And all of a sudden now one of the ushers comes running in, says, Larry, the benches are cleared. Get out here. So I come running out and I stopped at the bench and tightened up my skates and went back out. And everybody had kind of paired up. And the only one that hadn't paired up was Schultz. And then I saw him kind of heading towards where LaFleur was. So I kind of took a route around him, and I cut him off and I grabbed Schultz. And so I wasn't expecting to fight or anything else. And so I had a good hold of him or whatever. And we're kind of backing out. And then all of a sudden he kind of grabbed me and tried to headbutt me. But when he did that, I got my right hand loose. And then we started.
And he beat the shit out of him.
Yeah.
Well, I had about three guys jump me from behind. Then there was I would have loved to. Moose Dupont was the first guy that jumped me. But yeah, that was a big brawl.
Did you like those games, Larry, when you played? I mean, it's kind of neat, right? Because Montreal was so strong offensively, and yet you were tough. And
yeah, that was the great thing about our team is that we could basically play any way. It was kind of like the great teams at Edmonton. You want to play it defensive, we'll play it defensive. You want to play it offensive, we'll play it offensive. You want to play it tough, we have guys that can play it tough. So
where did you learn how to fight? Were you a schoolyard? Did you fight in school? Were you a pretty
good? Well, I could, but I didn't have to.
He was bigger than the teachers.
I didn't.
I didn't. They still talk about a fight that this guy, John Coburn, who played for Hull Valance, and I had a fight in Brockville one night. And we started at the net and we finished at the far blue line.
Oh, no. Nice.
Yeah. Oh, it went for like 5-10 minutes.
I got a YouTube.
It was a good
that.
One. And Coburn was bigger than I was. But it's amazing when you start throwing them, you get this energy. It's amazing.
And when the big bird gets angry, watch out.
Let's talk. When Larry gets in a fight, he says, you get this energy. Huh? Let's talk to the guys you fought, see how their energy was.
Yeah.
So you didn't mind those games, Larry? I was said
no, I didn't mind
tough
it.
Games, knowing you're going to get
go
into
I didn't go looking for it, but, you know, it, and it's funny how, you know how it happened? My second year, maybe it was my first year, when I went down to Halifax, Al McNeil was my coach down there.
Yeah.
And Al played for Chicago, and I guess he was a tough son of a gun. He was from the East Coast and Nova Scotia, and I guess he could really throw him. And so he called me into the office, and he goes, Larry, do you like playing here? And I said, yeah, no, it's good. We got great guys and everything else. Do you want to keep playing here? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. He says, well, then you better start playing a little tougher and start using your size and, you know, and start being a little more forceful and whatever. And I said, what do you mean? He says, you better start kicking the shit out of some people because he said, it'll make it easier for you. And it happened for me. And I said, if you can't play that way, and then you're no good here, we'll have to send you to Muskegon. I go, where's that? He goes, it's away in the East Coast. And I go, holy geez. Here I've got my wife and my one-year-old son. I'm going, ooh. So next game, I think I had two fights, a goal, three assists. And I didn't stop. We got like, and back then every night bench clearing brawl, at least one or two every night, right. Everybody. That's where I learned most of my fighting.
When Larry and I were playing for Montreal and I was stirring up some shit in the corner and Dana Merzen, I might've ran the goalie. I can't remember.
No,
Mike Vernon.
No, you wouldn't do that. Russ.
No, you wouldn't do that.
So, can't
imagine.
Dana Merzen tells this story and now Dana and I are friends, but at that time we obviously did not like each other. Calgary, Montreal series. They won, but Dana Merzen was choking me and he kept lifting me up and I could not breathe. And I'm like, and Larry goes, Dana or Merzen, if you don't let him go, I'm going to get in there and I'm going to beat the shit out of you. And freaking Dana let me go. And I had forgot about that story. And Dana and I were somewhere and he goes, oh my God, my idol, Larry Robinson, swore he was going to kick the shit out of me if I didn't let you go. And so anyways, Larry was a tough son of a bitch. He didn't have to fight a lot because, early days he did fight and people saw what he could do. So,
you know, I'm wishing Rusty gets on me so bad, Larry, during these podcasts. I'm wishing you would have told Merzen to fill him a little more before he let him go. If he would have punched him in the throat, if he would have choked him a little harder, Russ wouldn't be so fucking lippy on their show all the time. We got to talk about the fans, Lair. I mean, those are some crazy days, you know, Philly fans and Boston, all those teams you play with. Any crazy shit that happened with the fans when you were playing during the game?
One night in Boston, it didn't involve me, but what happened was is we were, in Boston, the visiting dressing room, you have to go past the Boston bench.
Right.
And so I guess Chris Nylund was going across, and I don't know, he pushed somebody on the bench or something like that. And then the fans reached down and grabbed him and everything else. And then next thing you know, all hell broke loose. And so we're running across. But I think that was the only thing. I mean, fans are there. They pay their money to see the game, and they're allowed to say what they're allowed to say. But there's been a lot of guys that have gone up in the stands that have got suspended and so on. So I think Milbury and bunch of those
O'Reilly?
Guys.
Didn't O'Reilly do it in Boston?
O'Reilly went up in there. So, I mean, it's one thing to be tough, but then it's another thing to involve the fans. So I don't think the Montreal Canadiens liked that part. So we didn't, we didn't really get involved. I know one night, it wasn't in Montreal, but it was in Rochester. It was on Rochester.
Syracuse? Did they have a team?
One of those teams in the American League. And I guess it was a rough night, and we ended up beating them, but the fans were pissed off. And so the police escorted us out into the bus, and we were sitting there, and the bus is going back and forth like that. And I thought for sure they were going to tip the frigging bus. It was crazy.
Jesus.
Crazy.
Mob.
Yeah.
Referees, who did you hate? Who did you like?
All of them. The young referees today could learn a lot from the old guys, because at least you could talk to them. Some of these new guys now, you can't talk to them. You just can't talk to them. They're bigger than the game. So
that's what I
hate. There are some good ones out there still, but they've you know that you've had a great refereed game when you're not talking about them after the game.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
When all you can do after the game is talk about what a stupid play this guy, what did he do, and what a call, and this and that, then they didn't do their job, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a thankless job.
Yeah. Why can't you talk to them now? Fear of getting a penalty or something? Like if you lip off the
ref, no? They're like I said, they're bigger. They've got this ego.
Yeah.
And they think they're bigger than the game. And so they haven't learned yet.
Yeah, they don't realize the fans pay to watch the players, not them.
Right.
Oh, there you go.
That's good analogy, Russ.
Yeah.
Some have, but the ones who haven't really stick out, you know, like they're like Larry said, some of them are really good and some aren't. And the ones that aren't think that they're players and they're not.
Yeah. My favorite story ever was Paul Stewart, of course, right? Who was
Stewie.
Yeah. This is a true quote from Glenn Sather, because Stewart was coming through town, I think, doing the rocking chair tour. You know, it was going to be his last year as a ref. And, and where was he? He was going to retire. And I think his last game was in Edmonton. And they were interviewing guys and then talking to slots. He was either coach and GM or coach or whatever.
Or both.
And they said, you know, you've been around Paul Stewart your whole hockey career, Glenn. And Paul Stewart today said he's going to retire. And when he does, he's going to go to the high level bridge here in Edmonton. So it must have been Edmonton. And he's going to throw his skates off the bridge. And Slats paused and said, well, if he does that, I hope he's still wearing them. true story, right?
Slats is great. Yeah. He's quick.
Funniest guys, can you remember, Larry, when you played? Russ, he's got a million stories about guys who were just hilarious in the room. Hotel pranks.
Gila Point was the best.
Was he?
Oh, my God. Unbelievable. I mean, he was such a prankster. Every morning when you came to practice, first of all, you checked your seat, you checked your shorts, you checked your jock. You made sure if you didn't get there in time, your laces were cut. He went out one day, it was just starting to rain. So I pull out of my parking spot across from the forum. I turn on my windshield wipers and it's full of friggin' Vaseline. And so I couldn't friggin' see. So I had to pull into the garage next, and they had to clean off my garage. Oh, it just was non-stop.
Vaseline, you have to replace the windshield. Sorry, go ahead.
Almost. No. I heard from his wife that he said that he used to do that stuff to his wife when she was at home. She'd get up off the dinner table and go to get something, and he'd pour water on her seat, and she'd come back down and sit down on the freaking water.
I thought you were going to say he put Tabasco sauce in her jock or something. Oh, he kept doing it to his wife.
Maybe he could. Oh, he did that to Claude Ruel one day, and so Claude goes out for practice, and we're all sitting there, and Guy comes over and he goes, look at Piton. So I look at him, and his face is fucking beet red, and he's standing there, and he's kind of turning this way, and he's turning that way, and he's kind of folding his legs as if he's got to have a leak, and he goes, I put hot stuff in his jock.
Oh, Jesus.
He went, poor Claude went the whole practice like that. He came off, and I think he went to the trainer's room, and he said he had almost second degree burns on his balls and his where the jock was. Oh God, what a man. What Jesus. A man.
God, that ranks right up there with you. That hasn't changed in the game over all the years, that's for sure, right?
Oh no, there's still. I'll tell you another good one that Guy did. And this, to me, this is my all-time favorite. So when he gets out, he started scouting. Right. And you know, he was scouting for, I think, Calgary or whatever. So the scouts, I guess they meet. They all stay at the same places or whatever. So he goes over with this guy to watch the game. And so they get to the game, they stop, and they start walking to the rink. And Guy goes, oh, I forgot something in the car. Give me your keys. So he gets back into the car, drove the car around the other side of the rink and hit it. Came back in, went over, sat down, give the guy his keys back. So then he doesn't say anything, and they go through. They go through, and the same guy goes to the bathroom as the 50-50 draw. So went away. He takes his, he says, give me your thing and I'll get it for the 50-50. So went away, the guy goes and he comes back and he goes, holy, you won, you friggin' won here. And he gives him back the key. And he didn't win. He would stop. So anyway, the guy walked all the way down to go collect his money. And the guy goes, no, you didn't win. And it was, anyway, so after the game, they come out and they're looking around and they're going, where the hell's my car?
Right.
Holy shit, Guy goes, oh, maybe somebody must have stole it. So anyway, they call the cops. The cops come. They're looking around for the car. So the cops go down around. He goes, oh, we found your car. It's around the other side of the room.
I got the headache going. I've been laughing so hard. You know that skull cramp you get when you're laughing?
Oh, nonstop.
I'm writing this shit down. I want to do this. I want to do this to my kids. I'm going to do it to you. So any shit. It'll be great. Larry, this is fantastic, man. I knew it would be. What takes up your time now? First of all, I got to ask you, because no one really believes it if they don't know you really well, that you are heavily involved in the whole polo thing that you got involved in years ago. And I read...
Still.
So talk about that. What I read that you started the first polo club in Los Angeles?
No, I didn't start the... No, it wasn't in Los Angeles. There was a small, like... it was back, I don't know, in when I was about 27, 28. And my kids at that time were getting older. So I said, you know what, I want to give them something to do. They have to have, you know, they were just sitting around the house and at that time, all these little gangs were starting and the pool rooms and all this kind of stuff. I said, I don't want my kids doing that kind of stuff. So anyway, I grew up on a farm. I think it's a great life. And Steve Shutt bought a horse and he moved out west of Montreal. So I said, you know what? That sounds like a good idea. So I moved out there, bought a house and a piece of land. And then I was building my barn. So I had bought a horse and I boarded it at some friends of mine. And so anyway, I'm going over to ride my horse. And one day they said, did you ever play polo? And I go, I said, no, I'm not a very good swimmer. So they said, no, on horseback. And I said, what are you talking about? So anyway, I went out and watched, and they lent me a horse to try it. And I fell in love. It's basically polo is called hockey on horseback. So I started playing a little bit, and then I took 3 years of lessons, the riding lessons and everything, learning how to ride better and so on and so forth. And then when my barn was built, I bought two or three horses. I started out, and at one point I had 12 horses. 12 polo ponies.
And that's cheap. They're not very expensive, are they, to keep horses?
Not back then. They are now.
Right.
Back then, we used to get these horses that off the track that they weren't quite fast enough to be race horses, and we'd buy them for $400 or $500 and then train them ourselves. So nice. This young girl that's working for me, and as a matter of fact, she started when she was 14. And she was the daughter of these people that where I boarded mine, and right. She still works for me for this day. She's 54 years old now.
Are you competing? Do you have a team? How's it work?
What's your involvement it's clubs. Now? It's clubs right now. And basically I haven't played, I had AFib. My heart went into AFib 2 years ago. And nice. So I've been on blood thinners, and so it's kind of dangerous to be on blood thinners and play polo. So, right. I just kind of practice and fool around and take it kind of easy. But this summer I had a Watchman implant put in so that I can get off the blood thinners.
What's that?
And it's basically a left atrial appendage implant. So what they do is they go through your groin and up into your heart.
Yeah.
And it's like a little umbrella, and they put it through the tube, and then they pull it out, and then and it closes off this appendage in there, and then everything grows over it, and that's where all the blood clots start. And now, so I'm off the blood thinners now, and I'm basically on Plavix, which is like a heavy aspirin,
right,
and a baby aspirin. And then by January, I'll be off the Plavix and just on a baby aspirin. And
cool.
So,
do you live year round now, Larry, in Florida? Before we let you go.
I wasn't until this stupid pandemic came in. We used to go up north, and now that I can't go up north, I've sold my boat. And
you're in Bob Cajun, weren't you, with your boat?
No, actually, Thousand Islands.
All right, okay.
Right in the Thousand Islands, yeah.
Well,
you had a beautiful boat too. I remember that. Was it like 52?
Yeah, 52.
You and Greener.
Yeah, yeah. I see Greeny all the time. He's doing really, really, really well. Yeah. Good.
Awesome. Well, Larry, this is good probably buddies. The proudest moment of your life this past hour. It really,
it's got to put
the Stanley Cups all aside and say, yeah, I did the Suspendables podcast with Russ and Jim. You're a great man, Larry. Congratulations on everything you're doing. I'm glad your health is okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's fantastic. We're going to get you on again if you'll.
Yeah, please. I love it. Love it. It's the only time I get to see Rusty. I may come out, Rusty, because I've been thinking about going down to I have a honorary membership at Desert Falls in Palm Desert. And we're thinking about maybe if they lift this pandemic of flying out there, renting for a month and staying down there. So
perfect.
Maybe we can get together and hit the ball around.
Gretz is around at Sherwood. So I live at Sherwood now, and Gretz is here.
Yeah.
And so if you want to come out,
I'd love to.
Just we'd love to have you. You can stay with me, or you can stay in the Manchun.
Okay.
I don't know if you want. It's a long walk to the bathroom at Gretz's house. I know when Walter went there and stayed over the first night, he got up in the middle of the night to take a leak, and it took him 3 hours to find his bedroom.
Well, I'm glad you got an invite to Sherwood, Larry. That's nice you got one. Okay.
I'll bring you with me. You could be my date, Jim.
Yeah. That's one reason we're keeping the border closed.
Larry, take care of yourself, man. This has been fantastic, and really appreciate it, man. Congratulations on your career.
Love you, too.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Larry.
Bye-bye now.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortinel in L.A. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And, of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.